morning, all. The first case for argument this morning is Moriarty versus Svec. Mr. Cho.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is James Cho. I represent the defendant, James Svec, in this matter. Mr. Svec appeals the district court's erroneous decision finding that he owes contributions for the first half of 1987. Furthermore, Mr. Svec appeals the excessive amount of attorney's fees and costs that were awarded to the plaintiff in this case. The district court should have found that the any amount of ownership rule applied in 1987 based on the following evidence. First, Stephen Dawson, FDSA president, stated that any contributions were not owed on behalf of anyone who held any amount of ownership in the business. John Barron, FDES Secretary Treasurer, also testified that contributions were not owed on behalf of anyone who held any amount of ownership in the business.
Do you agree that if somebody only owned 3%, though, that or something like that, they're not a principal owner?
Our position is if they own any amount of ownership in a business, that they would be considered a principal owner and would not be required to pay contributions on their own behalf.
Any.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
Also, in Moriarty versus Hitzman, the district court credited the testimony of Moriarty that no contributions were owed for any owners as well, even owners who held at least one share of stock. And this testimony was undisputed, and the Seventh Circuit in Gluckert also found that as well. James Lamont, the plaintiff's own auditor, also testified that in 1991, if an individual held any amount of ownership interests in an entity, they would be considered an owner and would not be required to pay contributions on their own behalf. Finally, the funds failed to provide any instance in 1987 in which they sought or required contributions to be paid on behalf of individuals who owned an ownership interest in an employer. The district court erred in relying on Moriarty's affidavit for a number of reasons. First, this court remanded to the district court the ownership issue that applied in 1987. Moriarty presented no evidence at all as to how the rule was applied in 1987, nor did he provide specific facts as to what constituted a substantial or significant ownership interest under the alleged pre-1993 rule. Instead, plaintiff cites two hypothetical scenarios about an ownership interest which Moriarty and Trustee Coley disagree, and their own auditor, James Lamont, refutes. For example, Moriarty testified that an individual who owned 25% of an ownership interest would be exempt, but not a 10% ownership interest. Trustee Coley...
That's why I asked you your percentage here. You're relying on this rule or this interpretation that if there's no... If you're a family member, you're exempt, period.
That is correct, right? Your Honor.
Is there a if you lost on that, what is the percentage that you would say is sufficient to qualify for an exempt owner?
Well, Your Honor, it is our position that it's any amount of ownership. As this court held in Gluckert Funeral Homes, mom-and-pop organizations are exempt from paying contributions on their own behalf, and Svec & Sons is such an organization. It's a mom-and-pop funeral home that's owned by James Svec as a sole proprietorship. And as the owner, he should not be required to pay contributions on his own behalf, for which he will never receive benefits anyways. So again, it's the any amount of ownership principle that applies in this case, Your Honor.
So if you had a company that had 50 employees and they were all brothers and sisters and that, then there would be no contributions, that would be all.
Well, that's an extreme case, Your Honor.
Well, what is the limiting principle for mom and pop?
Well, as even Mortier testified in his declaration, it's looked at on a case-by-case basis. In this case, the only owners, we're not talking about 50 sons and daughters, we're talking about only one employee, individual James Svec, who owns this funeral home. For a point in time, he owned it in conjunction with his sister. We're not talking about 50 sons and daughters. We're only talking about one individual, which he co-owned with his father at the time when his father was still alive.
Okay.
In Moriarty's declaration, he attested to a 10% rule that applied after 1993, but again, the issue on remand is not what applied after 1993, but what applied in 1987. The plaintiffs can't have it both ways. They can't say a 10% rule applied after 1993, but also now claim that this 10% rule applies in 1987. The court needs to be mindful of the retroactivity issue. The funds can't arbitrarily set a rule in 1993 and then say, well, we're going to apply this rule back to 1987 and say this 10% rule now applies, without never having any notice of such a rule ever being in place at the time, at least in 1987. While we recognize the court has already dealt with the issue of West Suburban Livery, we want to point out for the court additional facts that were presented at the lower court that requires this court to revisit the issue as to this court's jurisdiction over West Suburban Livery. First, during the deposition of Auditor James Lamont, he testified that during the first audit of Sveck & Sons in 1995, they found that no contributions were owed on behalf of Mr. Sveck since he was an owner. And that was based on the testimony of the auditor, of the plaintiff's own auditor. In addition, during that first audit, they found that no contributions were owed on behalf of West Suburban Livery because it was not a party to the collective bargaining agreement. It was only after the funds manager, William Coley, objected to this report did the funds and the funds auditors conduct a re-audit and found that James Sveck was indeed liable for contributions, and also that the employees of West Suburban Livery were entitled to, or contributions were owed on their behalf as well. Tellingly, in the settlement agreement proposed early on in these negotiations with the union or the funds, they required Mr. Sveck to recognize the union as a condition of settlement in this case. And it is abundantly clear on remand that the only purpose for the funds to go after West Suburban Livery was to seek recognition of its employees.
Joe, do you want to speak to the attorney's fees issue?
Right. In terms of the attorney's fees issues, the district court erred in its award of attorney's fees for a number of reasons. First, the district court awarded attorney's fees at the inflated rate, at the rate not that was actually charged to the funds, but at a rate that it came up with arbitrarily. The court awarded fees at the rate of $225 per hour for partners and $220 for associates, even though this court and the district court earlier in 99 had determined that the market rate for this case was $165.
Now, is it true that the district court in March of 98, and this I don't believe is cited by either party, found rates of $225 and $200 reasonable?
That is correct, Your Honor, but it was in October of 99, and the record at docket number 134 is where the lower court then found, based on initial evidence, right, that the $165 was the appropriate rate for attorney's fees. And that's the rate that was actually charged to the funds by the plaintiffs in this case. In addition, the funds needlessly prolonged this litigation by refusing to dismiss the claims against Mr. Sveck for the period after June of 1987, claiming that he was an owner or an employee still after that point in time, even though under Illinois state probate law, it was clear that he at least became an owner as of June of 1987.
I think the both parties have unreasonably prolonged this litigation. And to lay this all on Moriarty is a little unfair. Don't you think you have some responsibility here too?
Well, it was
third time.
Right, that is correct.
Folks have been here, which is pretty unusual.
Right, and we're hoping this is the last time, Your Honor.
We are too.
In terms of the
attorney's fees aside, what's the amount in dispute here?
They were awarded $40,000 approximately in attorney's fees. The amount that they actually recovered in contributions was about $20,000. So it's basically a 2-to-1 ratio. And in addition, the court awarded interest, double interest, and audit costs after November 1997, even though they had caught off attorney's fees as of November and then eventually December of 1997. And it is our position that this was inappropriate.
Now, Is it your understanding that the district court claimed that the 225 rate is the law of the case?
No, that's not our position.
Did the district court claim that the law, the case, bars that rate?
Right, that isn't right. The district court was incorrect because it must have not recognized in October of 99 that it had ruled that the 165 amount was the appropriate figure, and even this court recognized on the second remand that the $165 amount was the appropriate figure to use.
Yeah, but didn't the district court, in referring to the 225 rate, talk about the law of the case?
Right, that is correct, Your Honor.
What's your sense of what the district court was doing there?
Well, it must have looked at prior pleadings, but not recognized the fact that it had previously ruled that the 165 was the appropriate rate. I mean, there have been a number of pleadings in this case. I can understand why it must have missed that figure. And finally, it does not make sense for the court to have awarded interest, double interest, audit costs after the point in time it cut off the amount of attorney's fees, because the district court isn't required to award all of that additional costs, interest, and double interest, especially in light of the fact that it cut off attorney's fees as of December of 97.
Yeah, now, he cut it off in but earlier, in November of 97, didn't he find the offer to be substantial?
That is correct, Your Honor. I noticed that my time is running short. Do you mind if I answer the question?
Well, it mean a lot to me.
Right. it is correct. The district court did find in November of 97 that a substantial offer had been made, and it was only on reliance on this court's decision that it determined that the appropriate date should be December of 97.
All right.
Thank you.
Thanks, Joe. All right. Mr. Latham?
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is William Latham, and I represent Mr. Moriarty. I'd like to spend just a few minutes addressing some of the points raised by Mr. Cho before I go into the issues raised in Moriarty's cross appeal.
Is it true that the amount in dispute between January 87 and June is $2,300 or $2,400, and that, Is that what we're, aside from attorney's fees, is that why we're here?
With claim one having been resolved, that's correct, Your Honor. Claim two was only worth that much money.
Right. So it's a little under $2,400. I mean, I'm just following up an inquiry by my brother. $2,400. So it isn't $20,000.
$20,000.
Mr. Cho, or maybe you could explain the difference. I just want to get a focus on what we're talking about here, apart from attorney's fees.
Yes, Your Honor will recall that Moriarty's claim for contributions was two-pronged, and the $20,000 includes the contributions awarded against WSL, which
right.
was claim one, and then the balance of claim two, which was against the funeral home and Mr. Stack.
Okay, thank you.
I wanted to make clear, first of all, that the district court's finding that James's 3.82% ownership was not enough to make him a significant or substantial owner is correct. And the standard was the significant or substantial ownership amount, not the 10% rule. The reason 10% got into this case is James had argued that over and over again below. And this court acknowledged in fact, too, when it remanded and indicated that James had argued that 10% applied. Moriarty agreed on remand, but said if the 10% rule does not apply, then the substantial / significant ownership rule applies. Mm-hmm. And Moriarty's affidavit clearly discussed the substantial significant ownership rule, and the district court relied on that. The language of the district court repeats over and over again that the substantial significant ownership rule applied, and that under that rule, as it was applied by the trustees on a consistent basis, was 3.82% simply did not meet the threshold, which would have been at least a minimum of 10%. In 1993, the fund put into effect a bright line 10% or more rule.
Let me turn to the attorney's fees,
yes.
I can. I'm having a little problem discerning what went on after we remanded this case. Similar to the inquiry I made of Mr. Cho, Do we need a remand here to have the district court explain why it awarded $200 and $225, assuming we handle the other issue, rather than $165?
No, that was not an issue. I believe that what Judge Lindberg indicated was the law of the case held at the earlier rate of $225 and $200 and during Phase 1. That was the law of the case because at that point in time no evidence had been submitted by James to oppose that. Additional evidence did come in later and the court entertained that but did not feel that it was proper to go back and reopen issues that were previously litigated, albeit without any evidence from James to refute the fee
amount. Well, did the district court decide that both the November and December were substantial offers?
The district court did decide that, and it erred in doing so, Your Honor. I think Spec 2 made it pretty clear what the standard was when it went to the district court to determine whether James's offer was substantial. Language was, an offer is substantial if the offered amount appears to be roughly equal to or more than the total damages recovered by the prevailing party. And, of course, the court further instructed that damages in ERISA cases include the statutory add-ons. I suppose that the problem that we encountered below was that Spec 2 did not establish guidelines as to what does substantial mean.
Well, I'll tell you, Spec 3, if it goes back, will be very, very clear.
I certainly hope so, Your Honor. And we had argued that the 85% should equate to being substantial because this court, other courts, Congress, the Internal Revenue Code have all used 85% as the benchmark for what substantially all means. And in this case, if you apply the test that Spec 2 articulated, which is comparing the offer to the total damages recovered, James's offer comes out to be 52%. That's not substantial under any circumstance. In fact, Justice Easterbrook had asked rhetorically.
Judge. Maybe someday, Justice. Today, Judge. The only judge is here.
Okay. Judge Easterbrook.
Justices, you got to go east.
Yes, sir. He had indicated that, would a business consider
and,
that.
And what, and you're quoting from the judge in what opinion?
That was in Continental Can versus the Chicago
Well, there are no
Drivers
opinions
case.
Of judges in this court. There are just court opinions.
Okay.
Dissents you identify by members. But if he's speaking for the court, it's the court.
Understood. Right. And what the court said in that case, in a rhetorical question, was would a company whose customer paid 50.1% of the bill think it had received substantially all of the price? Obviously, the answer is no. In this case, 52% if we apply the The district court erred by incorrectly reading Spec 2 as holding that there was a substantial settlement offer made back in December of 1997 and without any analysis whatsoever jumped to the conclusion that Moriarty should not be entitled to any fees beyond that date. But the district court erred because it failed to make any consideration as to whether the offer was, in fact, substantial.
Was everything below on the pleadings? Were there any arguments had below, oral arguments?
There were no oral arguments. Everything was done on the papers, Your Honor. And if you take a look at the test that the district court did apply, albeit the wrong one, where it compared the offer or James's offer to an earlier offer by Moriarty, which had long been withdrawn in any event. But when you compare the numbers
what
there...
What do you mean long been withdrawn? It wasn't...
Well, the offer was...
How long was it?
Months, Your Honor. The offer had been made
months,
in September.
This litigation has gone on for years. How can you say a month or so was a long period of time?
I'll put it in perspective. Moriarty's opening volley was back on September 11th of 1997, and that offer was rejected. And at that point, counteroffer was made. That was rejected. Moriarty's initial offer was taken off the table. And by the time November of 1997 rolled around, Moriarty's fees had increased substantially. And the reason for that was because he had been briefing summary judgment. Now, if you take a look at the numbers at that point in time, which the district court refused to do, the way that the numbers balance out was that the percentages were extremely low. If you take a look at what the total damages were for Moriarty as of November 1997, it was less than 72%. It's even lower in December of 1997 because the additional attorney's fees increased Moriarty's claim to over $103,000. And the offer to recover ratio in that instance was less than 42%. These offers simply are not substantial under any kind of an articulated guideline. Further, this court had instructed the district court to consider other factors in addition to the proportionality, but there was no consideration of other factors. We argue below that things that need to be looked at are time value of money, creditworthiness, things of that nature, which normally tie into a settlement agreement or a settlement discussion. In this case, none of those considerations were looked at. And the district court further erred because in the end, having just decided that there was a substantial settlement offer and slashing Moriarty's fees as of December 1997, it effectively reduced the Phase 1 fees. Court lost sight of the fact that Phase 1 fees included fees that were awarded because of Moriarty's Claim 1 against WSL. The court also went on to strike out all the Phase 2 fees, which was wrong because this court's instruction was that Phase 1 or 2 fees should not be reduced absent some kind of a change of law of the case, and none of that occurred. There was a change. It certainly wasn't pointed out to the parties.
Let me just go back to this ownership thing before you
yes.
sit down. If your position is he owns a little less than 4%, who owns the rest?
On the annual revenue test, the balance, the 96%, was owned by James's father, Elmer. There were only two owners in this case.
And Elmer is no longer involved in the business, hadn't been since 87.
Elmer passed on in June of 1987.
So his estate owns the rest?
The relevant time period here was January to June of 1987, and during that June period, or that six-month period, that's where the annual revenue test was applied to determine the percentage of ownership. And for that six-month period, James owned 4%, his father owned 96%. That was the only six-month period of time at issue below.
Okay.
Was that 4% attributable only to WSL and the combination as a result came out to 4% or something like that, 3.8%?
That was determined by the annual revenue test, which is, I thought, a little complicated.
Well, I know it's complicated, but I try to uncomplicate it. It seems that the father owned all of the funeral home and James owned half WSL, and that one half, when combined, gave him a 3.8% or something. Is that the wrong summary? Well, wait a minute. If you don't know, then I don't want to get any deeper than that.
Yeah, I'd be guessing. All the factors were laid out in detail and admitted to in discovery. We had certain requests to admit following all the guidelines for establishing annual revenues. And it was agreed that it came out to be the 4%. That was not the dispute.
Right.
The problem, of course, for Mr. Speck was that having argued 10% all along, he's suddenly faced with the reality that he's going to lose having only a 4% ownership of under the annual revenue test. And that's when he shifted gears entirely and concocted a new theory that the any amount of ownership rule should apply. The district court correctly observed that Mr. Speck did not produce one iota of material evidence to substantiate that claim. On the other hand, Moriarty produced undisputed evidence in the form of his affidavit, and that discussed the substantial significant ownership test. The district court was correct in finding that the 4% was not a substantial or significant ownership. The district court did err, however, in its attorney's fees determinations, first determining that there was a substantial offer. That was wrong. And then it erred by further reducing Moriarty's fees by simply slashing them without any analysis whatsoever. The district court should be reversed on that. Unless the court has any more questions, I believe I'm done, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Williams.
Thank you.
Mr. Cho?
Your Honor, a couple of points. First, it is the fund's position that sons are excluded. Even in other settlement agreements with other funeral homes, they have specifically excluded sons of funeral homes and determined that those individuals are not required to pay contributions on their behalf. Even today, in response to your questions, the funds still have not articulated the rule that applied in 1987. They're now bootstrapping onto a position that Spike did take earlier, that their 10% rule did apply, but even they haven't articulated what that percentage should be. And based on the evidence that we present to the district court, it's the position of Mr. Speck that the any amount of ownership rule does apply in this case. In terms of the damages cited by plaintiff, they're basing their damages on the inflated attorney's rates. They've not been candid with the district court in telling the district court what their rates were, and now in terms of their assessment of damages, they're still relying on the inflated rates that they've requested before and not the lower amount. And finally, in terms of the substantial settlement offer, I don't know what can be more substantial than agreeing to pay the total amount of damages that the plaintiffs have requested in the first place. And in terms of the annual revenue test, that test isn't even used by the funds in determining the amount of ownership at all either. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cho. Thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement.